Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. So tonight's lecture marks the conclusion of Women in Design's events celebrating International Women's Day. The focus has been feminine power, sidestepping the normative assumptions about what success and agency look like within the design fields, and instead searching for alternative ways to understand power. Events circled around three themes: feminist epistemologies in design, foregrounding women's work, and workshopping emergent practices. We strove to gather members from our own GSD community to celebrate and cultivate new ways of thinking about gender and power. Tonight's lecture is no exception. Women in Design is delighted to welcome Beatrice Colomina to our school as the concluding keynote speaker. Beatrice is professor of history and theory in the School of Architecture and founding director of the program in media and modernity at Princeton University. She has written extensively on questions of architecture, art, sexuality, and media. Her books include Are We Human? Notes on an Archaeology of Design, The Century of the Bed, Manifesto Architecture, The Ghost of Mies, Clip Stamp Fold, Domesticity at War, Privacy and Publicity, Modern Architecture as Mass Media, and Sexuality and Space. She has curated a number of exhibitions, including Clip Stamp Fold in 2006, Playboy Architecture in 2012, and Radical Pedagogies in 2014. She was curator with Mark Wigley of the Third Istanbul Design Biennial in 2016. She has been the recipient of diverse awards and fellowships, including the Samuel H. Kress Senior Fellowship at the Center for Advanced Studies in the Visual Arts, SOM Foundation, Le Corbusier Foundation, Graham Foundation, the Canadian Center for Architecture, the American Academy in Berlin, and the Getty Center in Los Angeles.
Tonight, we welcome her as an authority on gender and sexuality in the built environment. Some of the seeds of today's intense and immersive conversations, especially in the GSD, can be found in her work, particularly Sexuality in Space, from 1992. Would have loved to have gone to the conference, but I was three, of which she was the editor. In it, we can learn that the politics of space are always sexual. Architecture must be thought of as a system of representation in the same way that we think of drawings, photographs, models, film, or television. Not only because architecture is made available to us through these media, but because the built object is itself a system of representation. Likewise, the body has to be understood as a political construct, a product of such systems of representation rather than the means by which we encounter them. We here now find our interests and attentions in this particular moment shifting. We accept that architecture is a system of representation, but of whom and by whom? We accept the body as inherently political, but who's calling the shots here? We pull back the veil to shift our gaze from architecture as object to architecture as practice. Tonight's lecture is framed thusly. With and not and is the way in which women are usually credited alongside men in the official records, if they're credited at all. Women are the ghosts of modern architecture, everywhere present, crucial, but strangely invisible. Architecture is deeply collaborative, more like movie making than traditional visual art, but unlike movies, this is hardly ever acknowledged. Until recently, it's been a secret carefully guarded. So tonight, we make space to represent that which has been previously rendered invisible. Please welcome Beatrice Colomina.
Thank you very much for your generous introduction and for your invitation. It makes me really, really happy to be invited here precisely by the women in design. Not that Harvard has ever been not generous to me. One of the first lectures I was just mentioning, this I gave here when I was absolutely nobody. Not that anybody now, but I was absolutely nobody, like a kid, totally a kid, in 86, I think, starting to work on my dissertation. I gave three lectures here in this very room that are very much the beginning of my thinking of what could become privacy and publicity, modern architecture as mass media, and even if I didn't have the title or anything like that yet, but I have always enjoyed coming here and discussing things with you. So the question of collaboration, of course, has become, I think, an increasingly important and urgent, you can say, question. On the one hand, you can say that it's central to contemporary discussions in general of architecture if you want ever deeper engagement with shared software platforms that allow large number of people in different locations and disciplines to work together on the same project. On the other hand, I think it's also crucial to historians trying to understand the way in which architecture has been traditionally produced. Architecture is increasingly a collaborative field. We all know that, and yet it has been very difficult to acknowledge this very simple fact to architects. Much more difficult than film. Film has always recognized this. Why are we so stuck up with this question? At the end of a film, you have asked, even the makeup people, the hair people, the catering people are creating. We create nobody. I mean, we were out of their way to create just one person, even in situations like, for example, and this is pertinent to the Women in Design at Harvard that started that famous and really urgent petition to acknowledge that Denise Scott Brown as part of the Pritzker Prize, and it was still denied, right? How is it possible that an architecture firm recognized, acknowledged in their name Denise Scott Brown, and institutions such as the Pritzker Prize decide that that's irrelevant, right? And I think, some of the things that we need to think about. And precisely I was going to start with this question that you just read the paragraph of how women in architecture in general, this is an alternative title, the With and Without You, the Ghost of Modern Architecture, because in fact with and not an is precisely the way in which women architects are more frequently credited alongside men in the official records, and that is if they are credited at all. And in that, and this is a woman builder in 903 repairing the roof of the city hall in Berlin. So women had been in architecture for a very, very long time. It's just we don't see them. So in that sense, I can see that I say that women are the ghosts of modern architecture. Here is a ghost, for example. This is a photograph of the Barcelona Pavilion. There are very few photographs of the pavilion. Has anybody bothered to ask themselves, who is this woman standing at the edge of the carpet looking into the Barcelona Pavilion? Of course, it's Lili Reich, right? That not only collaborated with Miss Van der Rohe in the pavilion, but she was the one that was there the whole time where he kept going to Berlin. And so she's not only that, she did more than 23 exhibitions, industrial exhibitions in Barcelona at the same time that they did the pavilion. Fantastic exhibits, and she was crucial to the Barcelona Pavilion, but we still continue to say the Barcelona Pavilion of Miss Van der Rohe, of course, and there she is. The pavilion has not been inaugurated yet, and she is inspecting the setup. So women are the ghosts of modern architecture. This is a self-portrait of Lotte Besse, and this is a photograph of Otti Berger, a Bauhaus student who also actually died in a concentration camp and in a photograph of Lotte Besse. Also, we don't know enough about all these women that were part of the Bauhaus, and when the Bauhaus closed, the tragic stories of many of these. All this remains to be undone. But returning to the question of the ghost, and I guess I put this picture because it suggests this idea of the ghost, that women are really the ghosts of modern architecture, everywhere present, crucial, but strangely invisible. And acknowledge, I think they are destined to haunt the field forever. But correcting the record is not just a question of adding a few names or even thousands to the history of architecture. It's not just a matter of human justice or historical accuracy, but a way to more fully understand architecture and the complex ways in which it is produced. Architecture is deeply collaborative, more than like movie making than visual arts, for example, but unlike or traditional visual arts at least, but unlike movies, this is hardly ever acknowledged. Until recently, it has been secretly, carefully guarded. So I guess what I'm countering is this idea that we are going to get very far by simply adding women architects to the history of modern architecture. What we have to rethink fundamentally is the question of how architecture is being produced and the privileging of one single figure that we continue to... So it's a structural problem, that's what I'm trying to say. I'm not saying that it's not important to do a specific exercise of women that has not been acknowledged. I'm just saying that with this we will not get very far. To better understand the field of architecture, I think we liberate new potential. The gap between the words and with, which institutions, as you will see, institutions so vigilantly guard, needs to be rethought. With implies a helper, a secondary source of energy, and implies partnerships and equality. What is positive about the and is that it feeds on difference, on complexity, and may encourage more nuanced forms of production and discourse. And I will tell you a story of how I got into this whole question of the collaboration. It's almost 20 years ago, and I was invited to give a lecture in Madrid. And by the way, Madrid is incidentally the place where I was, the city where I was born. It was kind of an interesting occasion because by then, as I was already professor at Princeton, I have lectured everywhere, at Yale, at Harvard, at Princeton, at the AA, I don't know where, but you know, you never are anybody in your own country. So finally they decided that maybe I was worth their while, and they invited the Colegio de Arquitectos, which is very much a male kind of complete institute, and they invited me to give a lecture there. And I was working at that time, so that for those of you who know my work, know that it's way in my career. I was working on Charles André Eames at the time, but so I gave this lecture on the work of Charles André Eames, and particularly I was working on the Eames House. And to my surprise, most of the discussion at the dinner afterwards centered on the role of Ray, her background as a painter, her studies with Hans Hofmann. They knew everything. So, of course, I have mentioned when I was showing images of the house how the Hans Hofmann paintings were hanging horizontally from the ceiling, and how Ray had studied with Hans Hofmann. But otherwise, I had not really focused on the role of Ray. I have not brought up this theme at all, and I was also surprised that they brought this question, that they were so interested in the significance of Ray in the partnership, because I was surrounded by very, very well-known Spanish architects, some of whom even teach around here, but they were all men. There was not even a woman on the table. And also because, as I say, I had not brought the subject of race contribution at all in the lecture, I would have thought there was not a climate for or an interest or an audience for that kind of topic in Spain at that time. The conversation drifted, as usually happens in this occasion, and before we know, we are talking about Lili Roig and what enormous, massive roles he must have played in the development of Mies van der Rohe's architecture. They were saying about the importance of such projects of the Silk and Velvet Café in Berlin, the collaborative project of Mies with Lili Roig for the Exposition de la Mode in Berlin in 1927, when draperies in velvet and silk and hung from metal rods to form the space. And everyone, to my surprise, agreed that there was nothing in Mies' work previous to that collaboration with Lili Roig that will suggest this radical definition of a space by, let's say, suspended sensuous surfaces, which could become actually his trademark, as exemplified, of course, in the Tugendhat House. and the Barcelona Pavilion of 1929. I'm, of course, astonished because where I have always thought that that was obvious. I had never brought myself to, I mean, I have said things like this in seminars, but I have never brought myself to write something like that, that they were also aware of this incredible influence of Lili Reich. And then one of these famous architects says something that has stayed with me ever since. He says, it is like a little dirty little secret that we, that is we meaning all architects, keep. Something that we all know, that we all see, but we don't bring ourselves to talk about it. That's amazing. Right? So these guys are all guys, are controlling the entire situation in Spain, the schools of architecture, the institutes. They know, they see, they are in a kind of spontaneous situation after dinner, able to talk about it, but as he himself admitted, and I thought it was really beautiful that he would say it that way, that it's like a little dirty secret that we all know, that we all see. So, in fact, that made me think that the secrets of modern architecture are really like the secrets of a family, in which, of course, everybody knows that something is has happened, but nobody wants to talk about it, all this little secret. And it is perhaps because of a current cultural fascination with exposing the intimate that these secrets are now being unveiled little by little. If one is to just the publications of recent years or even of recent days, there is an increasing interest on the way in which architecture works, so to speak. It is as if we had become more concerned with the how than with the what, and the how is less about structure or building techniques, which was, of course, the interest of an earlier generation of historians, and more about interpersonal relations. The previous marginal details of how things actually happen in architectural practice are now coming into the light. The focus is shifting from the architect as a single figure and the building as an object to architecture as collaboration. This, for example, is Charles Eames with John Entenza. How can anybody think about Charles Eames and his Eames house without thinking about Entenza? That was, of course, the great promoter of all the case studies in California. So collaborations are multiple and complex. Attention is today starting to be paid to all professionals that are involved in the project, the partners, the engineers, the landscape architects, the interior designers, the employees, the builders, etc. Even photographers, graphic designers, critics, curators, he's more of a curator, right, than a critic, and all of those who produce the work in the media are being considered. It's no longer possible to ignore how much modern architecture is produced both in the media and as media. And this, of course, are the famous photographs of Julius Solman of the Richard Neutra house in Palm Street or the Pierre Koenig house. Without these pictures, the work will not exist. As Richard Neutra himself say about his photographer, Julius Solman, and Julius Solman, you know, he was a kid when Richard Neutra hired him. He was a fashion photographer. He had no idea how to photograph architects, so he trained him. But then he says, his work will always survive me. Film is stronger, and glossy prints are easier to ship than brute concrete, stainless steel, or even ideas. So he acknowledged the significance of this work. Today, even the clients who were previously treated as a problem for architecture or as witness to the effects of architecture are being considered as the active collaborators they are, as, for example, Edith Farnsworth, the famous doctor in Chicago and client of the Farnsworth House of Mies. Of course, many of the best works of architecture owe their strength to the client, and this is something that, of course, Alice Friedman studied very well. The post-war inaugurated a new kind, and here you have her, for example, Edith, in the office of Mies, working actively working with Myron Goldsmith in the design of her own house. The post-war period inaugurated a new kind of collaborative practice that has become increasingly difficult to ignore or to subsume between a heroic conception of an individual figure. MoMA, for example, held this exhibition on the Chicago firm SOM, Skidmore, Owens & Merrill, in 1950, acknowledging for the first time a corporate office. So here we have individuals giving way to a more anonymous collective, even in the exhibition of 1950. But when finally the names are put, this is the cover of the catalogue, when the names are finally written, then symptomatically a very significant woman in the firm, Nathalie Dubois, was systematically left out. So when they have to put all the names, all the men, male names appear, but Nathalie Dubois, who was actually the great architect of all these projects, the Lever House, the Pepsi building, the great Hilton International in Istanbul, she is never acknowledged to the point that at a certain point she left the firm. She was never promoted, etc. I brought this Fortune magazine because I think we are worse as architects, as the institutions of architects are worse than the popular press, because here you see Fortune a magazine that has no trouble acknowledging that Nathalie Dubois is the senior designer that did the preliminary drawings for the Union Carbide Tower, etc., etc. And here she is with Philip Johnson and Mario Salvadori, and you see that Philip Johnson knows perfectly well who she's dealing with, but the firm itself would never fully acknowledge her, and MoMA did not include her in the credit either. Also, during this period of the post-war year, all the great masters associated for the first time with other architects on key projects. For example, Mies van der Rohe worked with Philip Johnson on the Seagram building, with the crucial intervention as client of Phyllis Lambert, as both patron and young architect. You know that was Philip Lambert that convinced her father, Seagram, that wanted to hire a very conventional architect that Mies should do the building. So again, the Seagram building will not exist without Phyllis Lambert. In 1943, Walter Gropius founded the Architects Collaborative, TAC, with a group of young architects. And in 1963, he collaborated with the corporate office of Emery Roth and Sons for the Pan Am building. Many other examples, Wallace Harrison stole, if you want, from Le Corbusier, the forms for the new headquarters of the United Nations in New York. Rencourt has actually suggested that such partnerships are always overlooked, even though they often contribute the more idiosyncratic features of the buildings. Here still is the United Nations. Kurha's point is that that those are the perversions of the masters. From the 1930s, Kurha's wrote in 1996 when he began working with Lily Wright on, Mies left the theatrical to others, perversion by proxy, from her silk and velvet to Johnson's chains mail in the Four Seasons. What is the connection? Who took advantage? Once again, it's symptomatic to me that it takes an architect, not a critic or a historian, to point to the obvious. Even if, in fact, he gets the facts wrong, Lily Wright had been collaborating with Mies since the mid-20s, but the question is, the question of collaboration is what he gets right. Collaborations, to return to the initial point, is the secret life of modern architecture, the secret life of architects, in a way the domestic also life of architecture. And nowhere is this more evident than in architects who live and work together with couples for whom there is a complete identification between home life and office life. Precisely, I think the sensitivity of Kurhaus to the question of collaboration is also personal or autobiographical, in as much as OMA was also two couples, and of course there is Zaha Hadid that at some point joined the office only for 1 year, who was terribly unhappy, and actually in this collage it's also interesting that this is practically at the door, and in a I'm leaving, you guys can. So of course Madelon Brithendrop, Ren Koolhaas and Elia Zengelis and Zoe Zengelis were part of the practice, and many times, at least in the initial years, I haven't heard him complaining so much recently. He complained in the early years so much that despite the huge effort of naming his practice Office of ODR Practice, Office of Metropolitan Architecture, the press tended to prefer only one name, so they will continue to talk about Ren Koolhaas and not about OMA, and not acknowledging fully the rest of the partners. So, as I say, nowhere is this more emblematic than with architects that work and live together, with couples for whom there is a complete identification between home life and office life. Ray and Charles Eames in the 1950s provided actually a model for couplings in following generations, by couplings and me collaborations in which there is also some intimate relationship, in particular for Alison and Peter Smithson, whose partnership in turn provided a model for Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, believe it or not, and for Enrique Miralles and Carmen Pinos a generation later. So a couple, in a way, identifying themselves with other couples. These guys were absolutely obsessed with the Smithsons, whom they had met when they were very young kids studying in Urbino. Urbino was a school in Italy, a summer school where students from different parts of School of Architecture all over Europe will go there for 2 months with Giancarlo De Carlo. And they found themselves that with the Smithsons teaching there, and they form a long-time relationship. Couplings actually raise an enormous level of resentment and nervousness from all camps, and that includes women. The phallic myth of the solo architect, the isolated genius, is one of the most regressive and reactionary understandings of architecture, but unfortunately still the most pervasive. In this climate, I think there is much to learn from the Smithsons, if only to remind ourselves that it took more than half a century before women architects were on equal footing in partnership with men. Margaret MacDonald collaborated with Charles Rennie Mackintosh, Lily Reich with me, Charlotte Perrian with Le Corbusier, Aino Alto with Alvar Aalto, but their extraordinary influences was never completely acknowledged. Only with Charles and Ray Eames we did for the first time had a firm which at least in the name were recognized the two partners as equals. And only with the Smithsons did we have that a woman puts her name first and her work is finally fully acknowledged by all. Of course, institutions, particularly East Coast institutions, I must say, the Museum of Modern Art, the New York Times, Harvard University, I'm sorry, were in denial. A devastated Esther McCoy wrote to the Eames apologizing for an article that had just appeared in the New York Times where the name of Ray had been erased from the article. And she says, "Dear Charles and Ray, the Times story was an embarrassment to me as it must have been painful to you. It was originally, as requested, 5,000 words story and was cut at their request to 3,500, and when Paul Gordeberg received it, he called and said it was fine. Then he turned me over to editorial assistant and Barbara Whedon, who had endless complaints. I won't bore you with the two things we settled down on, a death struggle, where that Ray's name must be included. Imagine that you have to fight for that Ray's name must be included, and that the chase must not be called a casting couch. For 20 years, of course, the article appears and Ray has disappeared, and the chase is called a casting couch, right? For 20 years, I have worked peacefully with editors. Now, already in 1973, I have come up against two editors, 73, right, who are unbelievably arrogant, the basis of their complaint being that I didn't understand the broad audience. This is sheer nonsense. The broad audience does not object to a woman being credited for work. So this is the kind of things that critics like Esther McCoy had to deal with. But if the Museum of Modern Art, New York Times was terrible, the Museum of Modern Art was even worse. They never were able to acknowledge Ray Eames. Only Charles was credited in the institution's first exhibition of their work, that presented as one-man show, and they titled New Furniture Designed by Charles Eames in 1946. Now, this is particularly tragic because other members of the Eames office were also not credited for their work, including, and you see the whole team there, Gregory Eng, Harry Bertoia, Herbert Martyr, and Griswold Raethe, and all of them resigned from the office as a consequence. So MoMA may have thought that they were doing something very nice by crediting only Charles, but it had enormous consequences for the firm, because this was one of the most actually fruitful and productive moments of the office, and they all left. And the relationship was even personal. You have, for example, here Alexander Matter, who was the son of Herbert Matter, and was also here on top of this plywood elephant. So there was an intimate, also personal relationship, and all of this was sent to the garbage by this stupidity. The exhibition and catalogue of the good design exhibitions of the 1950s, where also Charles and Ray Eames were part, did not again give credit to Ray, who is in fact seen in many photographs installing the show next to the curator Edward Kaufman Jr. So, to my knowledge, she is the one really that is there doing all the work, but she's not doesn't appear in the credit. Only on the last page of the catalogue, there are a few lines crediting her with assistance in preparing the show and the book, but not really for the work itself. Even as late as 1973, the same year of the New York Times article, Arthur Dressler's introduction to the exhibition Charles Eames for the design collection did not properly credit Ray, which is only mentioned as an assistant. If institutions have difficulties acknowledging the Eames partnerships, the Smithsons, on the other hand, could identify. They were absolutely fascinated with the Eames. They followed them everywhere, and they kept writing to them these affectionate notes. At one level, their bond with their elder couple was personal. Their standard form of address in correspondence, this is all from the archives, is from RC to A, from A to R and C, from R, A and P. And they usually close with effusive displays like "you are very affectionately" or "we think of you often" and "much love." Their writings are also full of expressions of admiration. One by one, all of the pieces of the Eames work are treated as precious icons, magical tokens that are presented as paradigms for their own practice. Of the Eames chair, the Smithsons will write, for example, that the chair was like a message of hope from another planet. That is the only chair that one could put in an interior today, they say, the only one they will put in their own living room. Eames chairs, they say, they belong to the occupant. They belong to the cat, apparently, but the Eames chairs belong to the occupant, which I think is a very interesting observation. Eames chairs are especially of the building and not of the occupant. I think everybody will agree with this. No, when you look at the Barcelona chair, you think, I mean, who is this chair made for? I mean, I was fascinated when the Sana, Sejima Nishizawa did that beautiful installation in the Barcelona pavilion, and I saw this them sitting in one of the stools signing the book, and they perfectly fit. I mean, whose bodies that will feel comfortable in these chairs of Miss? In any case, of the Eames select and arranged technique, the words of the Smithsons, says, as a design method, is closer to flower arrangement and to good taste in the furnishing of rooms with collectors' pieces. And then they claim to have used the method themselves in designing and equipping our own houses. The Eames, they write, had made it respectable to like pretty things. This seems extraordinary, but in our world, pretty things are equated with social irresponsibility. Now, of the IMS unique photographic technique, the Smithsonian Rite, we ourselves are very attentive listeners and watchers of everything the IMS have made. You see this complete obsession with everything, right? We have taken their invention of the flat on color documentation of objects as part of the way we now also work. So you can see that in every instance we are presented with something, with an acute actually observation of an aspect of the IMS work, and then at the same time with the way in which they, the Smithsonians, had appropriated it and made it theirs. Take for example the smooth transition from using the IMS chairs, as they say before, to designing their own furniture. And they write, with the first interior sketches of this project burrowsly formed, we realized we had a problem. What was to be put in as furniture? We needed objects that achieve a cultural fit. They could not be falling back on the Tonnette chair sold in France and used by Le Corbusier. As a response to this realization came the trundling Targ, a chair which looks as if it might follow you or follow its owner from room to room and on to the beach. So here is the chair that the Smithsonian designed, and incredibly enough was appropriated immediately by the Enrique Miralles and Carmen Pinos. They reproduced this house and they installed it in their house. The Smithsonian chairs take on precisely the same characteristics they ascribe to the IMS chairs. They occupy the space vacated by the Tonnette. They are from the same period as the architecture, as for example in the Smithsonian's House of the Future, where they are clearly inspired by the IMS, but at the same time is also different. And very important, they belong to the occupant and not to the building. So the Smithsonians put themselves in the place of the IMS, absorbing their mode of operation rather than the specific details of their form. But the key symptoms of identification between the Smithsonians and the IMS are not just the endless reference to particular aspects of the IMS work, they are also in the couple's techniques of presenting themselves, in the kinds of obsessions they manifest. And above all, and perhaps this is not surprising, when one couple bonds with another, the symptoms are in the pervasive sense of domesticity. Literal domesticity, as when Peter Smithson reflects on the IMS breakfast table, and of course he says that for the IMS, the table, the breakfast table, is a form of architecture. Only then in the same movement to go back to Walter Gropius and Ise Gropius table, breakfast table in their home in Massachusetts near here, and we end up with an image of Alison at breakfast on a snowy day in their country house in Fon Hill. So they trace this domesticity in all this and actually conceptual domesticity, as when in the same article Peter organizes the history of architecture from the Renaissance to the present as that of a family, a small family of only six members. Brunelleschi, Alberti, Francesco de Giorgio represented the generation of the Renaissance, and Mies, the IMS, and the Smithsonians representing three generations of modern architecture. Do you see that what it says there? Piper Auditorium. This is a lecture here. And the poster was done by a student from Harvard, apparently under instructions from Peter Smithson in a telephone call from London. So the three generations of the Renaissance and the three generations of the present. The Smithsons made many family trees. But what is incredible is the couple's insistence on the inclusion on themselves in these family trees. In the modern architectural genealogy, which they knew so well and which they were able to communicate in such brilliant ways in their writings, the Smithsonians wanted to see themselves as following the tradition of Mies. Peter, for example, writes, "My own debt to Mies is so great that it's difficult for me to disentangle what I hold as my own thoughts. So often they have been the results of insights received from him. So he cannot even know what he thought himself or what he got from Mies. But if Mies was the architect of the heroic period that they most admired, the Imps were like their favorite cousins, the ideal for the second less heroic generation, the generation straddling World War II. And it was with them, in fact, that the Smithsons fell a closer alliances. They keep producing these genealogies. For example, on the occasion of a lecture of Alison Smithson, where she goes and sees the Farnsworth House, she makes this genealogy, which goes from the Farnsworth House to the Imps House, to their own pavilion in Fawn Hill. Or then Villa Savoye, in another occasion, is Villa Savoye. So the Imps are the thing that stays. Do you realize that? So the Imps is always in the middle, right? Or in this particular case, the Ridwell House, the Imps House, and their house in Fawn Hills. In a lecture by Peter, in connection with the reconstruction of the 1956 exhibition of the Independent Group, he links the patio and pavilion with the Imps House and points out that the Imps had been familiar with the Mies sketch of the glass house of 1934, and again, different projects produce different genealogies. And this is interesting, again, to return to the question of women, because Peter Smithson, what a kind of I am, you know, because that could not be more separated from this idea and less sensitive to the question of women. Never mind. Peter was Smithson was significantly one of the first architects to point to the significance of women in modern architecture. He keep emphasizing women in what he calls the female line, and he writes much of our inheritance reaches us through the female line, and he mentions through Schroeder, who collaborated, of course, with Ridwell for their Ridwell House, Lily Reich, Charlotte Perriand, Ray Imps. Those are the four names he mentions. And, of course, the line continues all the way, in his view, to Alison Smithson in what Peter calls a conscious homage to the founding mothers. Now, we have talked a lot about the founding fathers. In architecture, it's always talking about the founding fathers. But this is the first time that I have heard the founding mothers. The Smithsons were very sensitive to women's presence in the history of architecture of our century, more than any historian or critic of that period. But the women they identify are always symptomatically in couples. And this may explain, for example, the symptomatic absence of significant figures like Eileen Gray, not of interest to them because they cannot put her in a partnership. So they refer to Margaret MacDonald and McIntosh. Probably you have never heard about Margaret MacDonald. Have you ever heard about Margaret MacDonald? Great collab. I mean, poor McIntosh, he spent his entire life saying that he was normal, that he was a genius. Nobody seemed to have believed him retroactively. But the thing is that in many ways, I think we have gone backwards. Because the other day I was doing research on something else, and I came upon this moment in the early 20th century when Margaret MacDonald goes with McIntosh and they put together an exhibition in Vienna. And all the newspapers and all the magazines talk about Margaret MacDonald, all the red-haired woman, this strong woman that has done this great project, and they practically don't mention him. So what's wrong with us? What's wrong that the journalists and the critics of the time had no problem recognizing her? And 18 years later, we're stuck with McIntosh and we don't know that he spent his entire life saying that he was actually quite a regular guy, that he was actually unbelievable. Why would he say that? Right? Why would he say that? Right? It has to be something, right? Okay, so what was I saying? So he refers to Margaret MacDonald and Rainey McIntosh, Charlotte Marianne and Le Corbusier, Trousseau de Sadler and Ridwell, Lily Reich and Mies, and so on. So a couple, in a way, identifying themselves with other couples, perhaps identifying other couples, perhaps identifying themselves with other couples. As Alison put it, I can see the part played by Ray Eames in all that they do, the perseverance in finding what exactly is wanted, although the seeker may not even know the exact object until finally is seen. When writing about Miss, Peter suddenly remarks, as if talking to himself, I want to know more about Lily Reich. And in a footnote to this, because this is in a text, right? And he writes a footnote to this very blunt comment, I want to know more about Lily Reich. You normally don't write that in a scholarly book, right? He won't write that. I think it's kind of fresh, right? I want to know more about Lily Reich. And in a footnote, he points out to this picture of Miss and Lily Reich in 1933, published in this book of Ludwig Glaser, this silvery book on Miss furniture on the collection of the Museum of Modern Art, but he says nothing about it. It's this picture of Miss and Reich on a boat where they each look in the other's direction, but their gaze symptomatically never cross. But it's also not just heterosexual couples that interest these missions, and this is fascinating to me. When discussing Johannes Ducker in the heroic period of modern architects, Peter Wright, it is not for me to deal with the relationship between Ducker and Bernard Byfoot. I speak of them as one eminence. In fact, Ducker and Byfoot have collaborated in many projects, including the famous Tonestral Sanatorium in Hilversum, the open-air schools in Amsterdam, etc. And do we know these projects as a collaboration? No, we tend to think about as the projects of Ducker. Same thing happened when Byfoot goes to Paris and collaborates with Pierre Sarrau in this beautiful Maison de Beurre in Paris. Last year, there was a beautiful exhibition in the Jewish Museum, extensive documentation, great material, and this poor Byfoot that had collaborated on the project was not even in the record. And you go like, how is it possible that they make such a big deal about how this was the best project of Sarrau and how nothing else that he did was anywhere closer to this? And could it be that Byfoot has something to do with it? Because he's the same guy that also did this, you know, that collaborated this, and it's also Ducker never did anything better than when he was with him. So actually something that Alison told me, actually she was very upset when Enrique Miralles split with Carmen Pinós. They were both very upset. It was like they were breaking themselves apart too. And they happened to be in New York. I have invited them to give a lecture in Princeton. This is 1992. And he said, you know, Beatrice, there is something in collaborations in which, what did he say? Something like the addition is higher than the sum of the parts. Something else happens that is beyond what each of us contribute. And she says they will never do, neither of them will rise to the same level that they did together again. And in a way, you know, that was actually a good prediction. Anyway, so Byfoot, yes, and speaking of soap operas, Byfoot arrived in Paris with his wife and his child and with the wife of Ducker. I mean, like, what? Right? And they were all living together in the same flat, and eventually Byfoot divorced his wife and married the wife of Ducker, Hermine. So, anyway, looking at the because it's also interesting that the whole history of modern architecture is full of soap operas that we don't talk about, but it's also, we have to look into that. That's super interesting. Why would we not look into that? That explains a lot about what happens, you know? Anyway, going back to this cover of the heroic period, I think it's already evident just by looking at the cover of this book on modern architecture, one of my favorite books on modern architecture, that it's evident already that these missions are interested in collaborations. For them, the history of architecture is the history of a conversation. You can see that it's not a heroic architect in the cover, but Mies and Le Corbusier in the grounds of the Weissenhof discussing this project, or here Le Corbusier and Gropius in a cafe in Paris again arguing, right, talking, right? Theams and team themes were, for them, occasions for a wider conversation, a kind of, if you want, a family conversation. And think about the difference between this... photographs of the Theam people or kind of like soldiers in the, and the kind of new situation that the team team is creating. So Alison also wrote, team team is a small family group, and this very much suggests this kind of pictures that you have of the Theam, of the team teams, very, very different of these ones, right? Alison wrote, team team is a small family group who knows each other so well that can begin to work together with a better mind that each could achieve alone. Again, the question of collaboration, that they could work together better than they could each of them work alone. And on the occasion of Pierre Jeanneret's death, Alison wrote a very moving report. Here, Alison and Peter, where they write, we have a very spare file called Significant Houses, and in it there is the Farnsworth, a few early Rudolph houses, and very little else. The earliest document is from the Architects' Journal, June 27, 1946. It is this which they thought of on the death of Pierre Jeanneret. The house shown here embodies the sweetest collaboration with Jean Prouvé, who really has been unfortunate in his architect's collaborators. So look at what is happening. These missions are paying tribute to Pierre Jeanneret by showing his house with Prouvé. So they remove him from Le Corbusier's gigantic figure, but only to pair him again right away in the sweetest collaboration. And in the process, they introduce the question of Prouvé and happy marriages, so to speak. Right? For example, when they say this thing. The suitors were with Jean Prouvé, who really has been unfortunate in his architect's collaborators. I mean, I think it's kind of opening a possibility of us to do a study here about what is going on with this collaboration, because, of course, Prouvé had collaborated with a succession of architects, including Tony Garnier, Marcel Lodz, Marette Steven, Le Corbusier, Candilis, Joseph Woods for the Freie University, etc. But since the homage was actually, remember that, to Jeanneret, bringing up the matter of partnerships raises questions about what is perhaps the most unexplored, the most unknown partnership of the century, and also the question of what Jeanneret may have contributed to the work of Le Corbusier. Nobody knows this poor Pierre Jeanneret. I have worked a lot on Le Corbusier. My dissertation was on Le Corbusier. I spent years in the Fondation Le Corbusier. I never knew that Jeanneret was so short. Look at him. It's not that Le Corbusier is a giant. He's really little. And I had to go with my students to... I taught a class on Chandigarh. I took the students to Chandigarh. In Chandigarh, oh, my God, in Chandigarh, they adore Jeanneret because he was there. He was the one that built Chandigarh. He went there. He spent years there. He wanted to be buried there. He died there. He loved India. And then I start paying attention to this Jeanneret and realize how little we know about this figure here in the beach. Boxing with Le Corbusier. And then finally, there is the love affairs. Here is Lotte Besse that we mentioned. Before, first student in the Bauhaus to be admitted in the architecture, you know, they were all put into the textile section, right? All the women, they were not allowed to be in the metal thing. I mean, it's a whole history there, right? So Lotte insisted on being in architecture and had actually an affair with Hannes Meyer until who had finally agreed that she will enter into the School of Architecture, but also told her that if he were to do that, he probably would have to associate herself professionally with a male architect because otherwise she will never be able to do anything in her life. Okay. And she did exactly that. She associated herself with him, said that he was married. Then he's made head of the Bauhaus, and she, who was still a student, was asked to leave. Why? Because it wouldn't look good that the director of the school was having a story with a student. Why doesn't he leave, right? Why don't they make him a director? He had to leave, right? But anyway, so here you have Lotte, Berse, and I don't know who is this guy, this creep in the background. But I don't know about... I mean, I think Lotte Berse is super fascinating. As you know, then she married Marth Tham and became Lotte Berse Stamp, and she was the head of the reconstruction of the whole of Rotterdam. She's a force, she's an unbelievable force in architecture. I'm not sure she was interested in any of these guys. Anyway, if you think about it, all the time that she's in this Bauhaus, she's always photographing this this Otti Berger and other women in the Bauhaus, amazing photographs. Annie and Joseph Albert, but particularly I want to, from other Lopes affairs, but I want to particularly talk about the affair of Catherine Bauer with what is his name? Louis Mumford, right? Which you see here. Catherine Bauer was a social historian who married, by the way, William Worcester in 1940, and in a way politicized him, infusing his domestic designs with her social and political ideas. But before that, he had also radically changed the work of Louis Mumford by inspiring him to take on the grand themes of technology and community, which will become the basis of his best-known books. And Mumford, in turn, encouraged Bauer to contemplate aspects of design that could not be quantified, to broaden and humanize her definition of housing reform during the several years of their love affair while he was married to someone else. Mumford had met Bauer in 1929. Listen to this, because you have read a lot about Mumford, but you haven't read this, I'm sure. We were drawn together by our common interest in modern architecture. From the beginning, we were excited by each other's mind and plunged and leap in a sea of ideas like two dolphins, even before our bodies got time for one another. Wow. Catherine's challenging mind, particularly in the first 2 years of our intimacy, had a stimulating and liberating effect on my whole development. In effect, she played the part of Hilda Bungle in Ibsen's play, the voice of the younger generation, bidding the master builder to quit building modest commonplace houses and to erect instead an audacious tower, even if when he had reached the top, he might fall to his death. Okay, wow. So there you have another Mumford from the one that you normally are talking about. And think one of the first women architects to graduate from Harvard University, from this place, became Louis Lucan. Lover, as you know, are working in his office and collaborating closely in the designs. In a letter to Ting, where she was in Rome in 1954, you want to know why she was in Rome? Because she got pregnant, and then, of course, because she was married to someone else, she was told to go to Rome. That's, you know, it was better, because otherwise it was kind of embarrassing. And she says in a letter, I'm waiting anxiously for us to be together again in our wonderful ways of love and work, which again is nothing really but another form of love. Lucan and Anting writes, we were both workaholics. In fact, work had become a kind of passionate play. We were able to bring out each other's creativity, building on each other's ideas. As the full tragedy of the relationship that you probably know well, even if you have seen, I don't know whether you have seen the film, and Kant's ultimate selfishness unfolds, the letters between them, which are all published in a book that was done by Rizzoli a few years ago, remain filled with the details of design. So published designs and private soap opera are here inseparable. As the institutions of record for the field, the Museum of Modern Art found itself in the middle of many questions and disputes of attribution. Ting, for example, who had ended her relationship with Kahn in 1960, shortly before the museum's visionary architecture exhibition, was surprised not to be credited for her work in the exhibition, and particularly for the City Tower in Philadelphia, which is really her project. She says, I did not get an invitation to the opening. When I asked our secretary about it, she said my name might not even be on the credit label. I immediately asked Lou if my name was credited. He answered no. So I suggested it may be better if he called the museum than if I called. There was no strongman drunk. He simply called and my name was added. I was profoundly shocked that Lou will do such a thing, especially since Perspector 2, Progressive Architecture, the Atlas, and a number of other publications already have been credited to both of us. I could not believe that his desire for recognition will erode his integrity, since sharing credit with me will not necessarily diminish his fame. In the end, the City Tower appear as Lucan and Anting, architects associated in the exhibition at MoMA. Can publicly, if inadequately, as you will see, acknowledge Carroll when in 1973, a year before his death, he gave